You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Soybean farmers are dealing with two problems lately: soggy ground that prevents them from planting and the ongoing tariff war with China. More than a year ago, China put retaliatory tariffs on commodities like corn and soybeans after the Trump administration put high tariffs on products like steel and aluminum from China. Since then, many soybean farmers have had a hard time finding a market to sell their crop. However, a gleam of hope came from Canada and Mexico in the past few weeks. On Monday, Canada took a first step toward ratifying a new North American trade agreement, just 3 days ahead of U.S. Vice President Mike Pence's trip to Ottawa to talk about passage of the treaty. Chuck White is a soybean farmer in Spencer, and he is the regional representative for the Iowa Soybean Association. White says the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal could be a big boost for soybean farmers in the U.S.
Yeah, as agriculture goes, anytime we get a trade agreement, it's very good news that we can especially get our neighbors to the north and south, Canada and Mexico, to open up their borders to free trade. And it was really great news to see that the aluminum and steel tariffs are going to be dropped. So that will help move this forward and get the Congress to ratify it. So, you know, anytime we can get better trade agreements with anybody around the world, that's tremendous news, I feel. And I think most farmers in America would agree with that. I think all the producer groups have been on board to move forward with this, and the sooner the better.
How much will this help, say, soybean farmers? Do they ordinarily sell a lot of soybeans to Canada and or Mexico?
Mexico has been a tremendous market for us. I know that right now, this year, they're third in line behind the EU countries. China is in second as far as exports yet, and Mexico's third. So we've got a potential for some great growth there. I know that personally, the aquaculture industry in Mexico has been expanding. I know they've got offshore aquaculture facilities. I've even visited some of those, and they're continuing to use U.S. soybeans in those diets, particularly the one plant I visited, or one facility, had products right out of Iowa being shipped down there, and equipment being shipped there to process and make this feed for the aquaculture industry there. Yep. As around the world goes, we're getting more interest in aquaculture. There's a big demand for more protein, and we'd like to see everybody eat beef and pork, but and chicken, but in some areas of the world, fishes are, you know, protein is of choice, and we can sure use the aquaculture industry to use more soybean meal.
Do you know if Mexico ordinarily buys a lot of corn from the U.S.?
Oh yes, oh yeah, yep. They're also a big corn importer. We export a lot of corn to Mexico. I don't know the exact number, how they stand in the number of exports that we make, but they're a big part of that.
How is the planting going? I've heard from a lot of people about the rain and how everything's too wet to plant.
Yeah, it depends on how dry your farms were. I know that everybody's been really running long hours when it does get dry enough. Personally, we've planted until 3 in the morning until midnight one night, and it rained us out both times. Otherwise, we'd have gone all night to get our acres planted. And we're about 60 to 70% planted on corn, but no soybeans have been planted yet. And there's farmers that have been fortunate to have some dry weather, and they've got everything planted as far as their corn crop, so I know of. And as far as soybeans, I don't think anybody that I can recall is really completed soybeans. A lot of them got started in their drier fields.
But if they're not planting their soybeans right now, it's not because they're concerned about the tariffs, it's because of the weather.
Right. Oh yeah. It's a weather issue. Everybody's geared up to get going, and you know, I know farmers that have two planters, one for corn and one for soybeans, and they run them both at the same time to get things planted as fast as they can. And so we're definitely trying to get things planted. That's for sure. We're in a time frame that's unprecedented. I believe the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, reported last week that the last 12 months have been record wet. And I think as farmers in Iowa, we sure know that. It has been tremendously wet. Last year, we had a lot of rain, especially my area in September. We had 10 inches in 2 days on the 19th and 20th of September, and that made it excessively wet for harvest. And now going into the spring months, it's just been steady rains. Some people have really had heavy amounts of rainfall, and that's been really detrimental. And there's other areas that have had just enough to keep the soils wet, since you can't get into plant. You got to have dry conditions, otherwise the seed goes into conditions that aren't at all advantageous for growth. So you got to get that right soil condition to get planting done.
But trade-wise, it sounds like you are hopeful that this North American trade deal is going to go through soon.
It was signed, last November, I believe, and toward the end of November. It's been 6 months now that we've been waiting to get that deal ratified by the Congress, and we're sure hopeful that that's going to happen now, since we've got the steel and aluminum tariffs dropped, and we're looking forward also to better times ahead for all trade, including China. That's been the one that's got the most attention, is the Chinese tariffs and all the problems we've had with lack of exports to China. But even maybe a bigger item on that front is that this African swine fever now is also really impacting the amount of soybean meal that's going to be used by the Chinese, and that affects the whole world's supply. So we're not only having the excess amount in the United States, but also South America sounds like they're going to have extra beans. So we've got to find a way to get other countries to use soybean meal and soybean products. As we've got a long way to go to get these extra beans off the market.
That was Chuck White, a Spencer soybean farmer and a regional director of the Iowa Soybean Association. White says he hopes the U.S.-Canada-Mexico trade deal goes forward to help farmers sell their soybeans. White is also hopeful President Donald Trump will come to terms with the Chinese and broker a deal that will end the trade war that has been going on for more than a year. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. Woodbury County supervisors have been quietly discussing the need to repair the current jail or to build a new, better facility. Chair of the board, Keith Radig, says it would cost a lot to fix the jail, but it would not create more space in an already crowded facility. Major Tony Wingert commands field services for Woodbury County, including the jail and patrol divisions. Wingert says from what he's been told, the space issue is a key factor in the decision to build a new jail in Woodbury County.
Well, actually, it was our building services manager, Kenny Schmitz, that came to us with his concerns about the HVAC system, the heating, the cooling, the air the inmates breathe. This jail was built back in 1987 and was designed for 90 people. We are now up to 234 people, and heating and cooling is not designed for that many bodies to be in there. So he was very concerned that those systems are aging and not adequate, and the way this building was built, it is going to cost millions of dollars to replace those if they were to break. And further we got into it, we figured it, Kenny told us we'd have to shut down half the building, meaning about 100 inmates would have to be moved out. And that is my nightmare scenario, trying to find 100 beds across the state of Iowa for Woodbury County's inmates is going to be darn near impossible.
I was talking to Keith Raddick about this, and he said that he had in mind a few spots that weren't too far away, kind of on the outskirts of the city, that might be good places for a new jail. What's your opinion? Do you think, would you rather see this jail dealt with, or would you prefer a new facility?
This facility has served its purpose. It was built on the cheap, and that's not a slam against anybody currently in office here. It was under-designed, and talking with Sheriff Amick, who was sheriff at the time, or was not sheriff at the time, but soon thereafter, they knew it wasn't going to be quite large enough. So they did it because they had a pressing need, and we've outgrown it. So my opinion is, why fix this and not gain any bed space, because we're at maximum capacity almost every day anyway, when we could spend a little bit more money and maybe fix it for the next 30 years where, you know, the taxpayers don't have to worry about it.
Has your need for beds grown? Have you seen more people in the jail?
Oh, yes. Yeah. My staff does a great job of working with the judges and the county attorneys and the public defenders. It's a juggling act to keep, you know, enough bed space for us. We have nobody in jail that shouldn't be in jail. Everybody that's in jail is one reason or another needs to be in jail. Now, could there be other people in jail? Yes. But we have to weigh the odds against our space and what the crimes are.
What do you think the timeline would be for either fixing this jail or building a new jail? It sounds like it could take a while.
That's out of my area. I know I'm talking to some people, and I said, hey, perfect world. We pass a bond this fall, and we're still 3 years away from ever setting foot into a facility. So it's going, you know, we're going to be 3 years of juggling this and hoping our HVAC system doesn't quit on us.
I know that we have specialty courts, especially in Woodbury County. We have a few of them. Do those specialty courts help get people out of jail, keep them out of jail, do you think?
Yes, I do. I'm very proud of what Woodbury County is doing with the Veterans Court, the Drug Court. It does help our population. The thing I have to say on that is, we've cut all the meat off the bone. We are doing everything we can do to keep our population down. There's not anything else that we haven't explored or tried to keep our population down. Now, it's when it grows, there's no stopping it.
So how much do you think it will cost to fix this facility or build a new jail?
Well, we'll get into this as we move along in the progress and the program. We're going to end up spending, I've heard numbers from $28 to $30 million to fix the building that we are currently in and not create one more bed, where it between $48 and $50 million to build a 400-bed facility. So I'm a taxpayer. I don't want to see my taxes go up, but it's a problem that we're going to either pay for it keeping our own jail, or we're going to pay for it farming our inmates out to other counties. So one way or the other, taxpayer is going to foot the bill, because I don't see the crime problem going away. It's just that, are we willing to take this on right now?
Do you think that Woodbury County might take in more ICE detainees?
Yeah, right now we have contracts with the United States Marshal Service and ICE. Now, we don't hold any ICE inmates. Well, we do for a day or two, just because we have no space. And our federal inmates, we can hold up to 20, but we are so full with local crime committers that we have to tell the marshals to get their people out and move them to a different facility. And yes, our plan would be to build the jail big enough that we could hold up to 100 federal inmates. Now, that could be a combination of ICE, marshals, whatever, but they can't promise us anything other than they can tell us, if you build it, we will come. They need bed space, but they can't give us any money up front or anything like that. They have to stay out of that process. So our plan is to, have extra beds. That would be revenue, and maybe enough revenue that we could pay our loan down every year with that.
That was Major Tony Wingert, who commands field services for the Woodbury County Jail and Patrol Divisions, talking about the need for a new jail or the need to fix the existing facility. While lack of space and a bad HVAC system are top reasons for many in the county to want a new jail, others are concerned that just building a bigger jail won't do anything to help keep people out of jail. And race is often a factor as well. Nationally, Iowa ranks very high when it comes to the percentage of African Americans who are arrested and jailed in the population. Daniel Zeno is a legal director for the American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa. Zeno says a high proportion of the minority population ends up in jail for crimes like drug possession, and they often have a hard time raising money to even get bailed out.
Possession of any kind of drugs, Iowa is the second worst in the country. Now, in terms of marijuana in particular, for marijuana, black people in Iowa are seven times more likely than white people to be arrested for marijuana possession. Even though, generally speaking, there's about equal use in both racial groups. And so there are some real, some big racial disparities. And, you know, one of the results of that is another issue we're working on, which is about voting rights for people with felony convictions. If there's sort of this disproportionate number of black people in the criminal justice system, there's a disproportionate number of people who get convicted of felonies and result in a disproportionate number of African Americans losing their right to vote.
And I know it's harder to find details on, you know, county jails.
Because I think in particularly for county jails, I mean, I think that would be much more about like the geographic area. Because, you know, if you got a county where they're really just, I mean, there just aren't a lot of people of color who live in the county, the numbers might be lower. Or, you know, maybe Polk County might look different because there's just more population, more black people who live in, you know, Linn County, Polk County, Scott, Black Hawk, you know, the areas where there's kind of bigger concentrations of black people, those county jails might have different disparities than other counties. But at this point, we don't have that data.
Well, I was talking to one of the people that helps manage the whole jail facility, but he said to me part of it, you know, here is that a lot of Native Americans who get stopped for drugs or alcohol, and they get put in there, and then they can't bail out.
Pre-trial incarceration. The number of people who are in jail before they're convicted, so it's before they have a trial and before they're convicted, and the only reason they're there is because they can't afford to pay the money to get out. They haven't been found guilty, they haven't been sentenced to anything, but they don't have the money to get out. We don't think that that's a good way to do things either, because, what it does is it disrupts people's lives in significant ways. If you are already living with low income and you're arrested for a crime, you're alleged to have committed a crime, and you're in jail for a week, you could lose your job and then later be found not guilty. But you lost your job. And because you lost your job, you could not be able to afford your rent or your car payment or your light bill. You know, I mean, so there are some pretty significant consequences from pretrial incarceration. We have a legal fellow who is on staff at the ACLU of Iowa who has specifically been looking at this issue, not pretrial detention, but kind of court debt, court costs, all of the things related to that. And how that also, there are some racial disparities in that, and how that negatively impacts poor people, people of color. And again, this is all about people who they've not been convicted of anything. They've been accused of committing a crime, but they haven't been convicted of anything. And, you know, I mean, that issue is not only an Iowa issue, but a national issue. People who have either substance abuse issues or mental health issues, who just sort of cycle through the criminal justice system for you know, sometimes it's trespassing charges or petty theft or, you know, the kinds of activities that people engage in to feed their addiction. And simply arresting them and putting them in jail for 7 days and then arrest them again. And then by the time they're 30, they got a rap sheet that's 10 pages long, right? But the core issue, their mental health issue or their addiction issue, that until you really address that issue, the criminal justice system is not helping, right? It's just sort of cycling them through. You know, in the criminal justice system, we do a whole lot of things. Do they work? And if they don't, can we sort of rethink, instead of every person who's alleged to have committed a crime or a person who's been convicted of a crime, instead of just locking everybody up, are there other things we could be doing? Because we, the United States, lock up more people than any other country in the world. It doesn't work. We just keep locking up people, right? So are there other things we could be doing? Can we be, you know, doing more community policing? Can we do more, you know, mental health services, substance abuse, addiction services, at least from the ACLU perspective, taking police out of schools? Because one of the things we think, what we believe happens is discipline issues, right? So kids in the cafeteria having a food fight. I mean, they're kids. Kids have, they do things like that. Clearly, there should be consequences, but that should be a school discipline issue and not the child is now charged with simple assault for throwing an object at another person and the object being a bread roll, right? And so there's all of these ways we sort of use the criminal justice system.
And you say there was a bill in this past session of the legislature that would have helped out in this area.
There was a bill this session to lower the penalty for first-time possession of small amounts of marijuana. Now, the point is not, you know, at this point to say there should be no consequences, right? But it's to say, should we send people to jail? Should we send college students or whoever they are who are using marijuana for their own personal use, should we have this harsh penalty or we send them to jail? We know that doesn't work. So let's think about other ways to do, to work, you know, use the criminal justice system so that it is fairer and that it actually helps.
Well, here in Woodbury County, there's been talk about building this bigger jail and getting some federal funds to defray the cost, housing immigrants detained by the federal government, and that's not an uncommon practice.
There are at least some, I don't think it's true in every county, but there are at least some counties where, so you know, Senate File 481, the immigration bill from last year passed. And so what that means is a person who is undocumented, who is arrested for a crime that they've been alleged to have committed, if ICE issues a request to the local law enforcement to hold that person so that ICE can come do their, you know, they're figuring out what the immigration issue is. Now law enforcement are required to hold the person up to 48 hours. And so there are some counties where the space in the jail is used to detain people who are on ICE holds. And so, I mean, there are all kinds of ways. And, you know, we know that there are, I mean, county jails, it's sort of kind of this perverse, the way you need people in the jail to get money, right? If you have a 200-bed jail and you got three people in there, it's not cost effective.
Daniel Zeno is a legal director for the ACLU of Iowa. He explains some of the disparities experienced by African Americans and other minorities in Iowa's legal system in terms of disparities in county and city jails. The city of Bettendorf has the highest disparity, with African Americans being arrested at nearly 10 times the rate of other races, according to a study done by USA Today and the Des Moines Register. The rate in Des Moines was also 10 times higher. By comparison, African Americans were being arrested at three times the rate of other races in Sioux City and two times higher countywide. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Starting Friday, the Siouxland Pride festivities begin. The Siouxland Pride Alliance and Sioux City Pride will host 2 weeks of LGBTQ Pride events to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising. Don Dew is the Executive Director of the Siouxland Disability Resource Center, and Karen Mackey, the Executive Director of the Siouxland Human Rights Commission, organized the Pride events. The first of the Pride Week festivities will kick off at 7 p.m. this Friday at Girls Inc. with the Pride Prom. Don Dew explains.
So the Pride Prom, and this is the seventh year for that, we actually take from the Gay Straight Alliances in the high schools what they want for, like, say, the theme or food or anything. And we've outgrown the First Unitarian Church where we usually have it. So it will be at Girls Inc. on Cook Street by Cook Park. And so the GSA kids, like to have free makeovers and a mini drag contest, so we'll have that. We always have, you know, free food, karaoke, dancing. They love to do dancing. But everything is free. It's open to everyone. Kids under 12 need to have a guardian or a parent with them, of course, but... It's a fun time. It's from 7 to 11 on May 31st, this Friday.
Yeah. Already. Coming up pretty quick.
Do you get a lot of people coming to this every year?
It has grown over the years. You know, the first few years we did it, if we had more than 25 people, we were doing great. The last couple of years, we've had between 125 and 140. Last year... we had kids show up as early as 5 o'clock for the 7 o'clock event. And the other thing we noticed was they stayed the whole time.
Right.
So, yes, we have a lot of people, and they seem to enjoy it. When we've been going to the GSAs to talk to them about it, they remember that it's happening. They're excited about it. So it is a lot of fun, but, yes, we absolutely had to move. We were just bursting at the seams at First Unitarian.
Well, that's good news, right? It's popular.
Yes. Yeah.
Do people ever come with their parents?
Actually, yes, they do. In fact, one of the things I found humorous last year, where we were having a little makeover thing, and that was some of the girls at the GSA really wanted to have makeovers. So we had people willing to do that. And pretty soon I see moms in the chair, or even dads getting makeovers.
Do these kids ever say that they didn't have a chance to go to their prom? Do they ever talk about that?
You know, yes, some of them, they may not feel comfortable going to their prom. It isn't so much that they aren't allowed to.
Right, because they don't force you to have a date or anything back in the day.
Yes, but they just aren't, they don't feel comfortable being out and having a same-sex partner, for example, with them.
Right. Well, you're also having... LGBTQ Pride walk and a reception that's
mm-hmm.
coming up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to have some awards.
We are. So we are going to be, this is our inaugural year of giving out this award, and it's called Hidden Heroes. And it will be honoring people who have positively impacted the LGBTQ community in Siouxland. So it is not just LGBTQ people, but also our allies. And you'll have to stay tuned to see who they are.
Yeah. So that'll be like right after the walk, then at the museum, you'll have that.
Yes, okay. We'll have that and then a reception.
You're having this the book discussion, Sex Crime Panic. This book is something I remember reading it a while ago, and mm-hmm. I had to go back to see if I could find another copy of it. It was fascinating. And I remember... my dad telling me about this happening when he was young. And mm-hmm. he said, I thought people had forgotten about it.
It is just a fascinating book. Neil Miller is the author of it. He is a gay historian from the East Coast. And he was here in the, I think it was early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, researching the book. Early 90s, I remember that. But... And he had heard rumors about this, because he is a gay historian. And so he spent quite a while in Sioux City doing background research and then tracking people down and ultimately writing the book. The interesting thing is when you read the book, most of the people that he talks about, he's writing about, he's used pseudonyms for them, even now, who it was. We're working with the library on that and the museum. And the museum got a Humanities Iowa grant that was able to make it happen to bring Mr. Neil Miller back here and to do a variety of other things.
Do people ever say to you, well, I'm not LGBTQ. Am I welcome to come to these events? Do people ever say, should I come?
We hear that sometimes.
Yeah. And all the time. I mean, I hear that a lot. And it's like, you know, I work in the disability field. People ask me, why should they, you know, care about disability issues if they're not disabled? It's the same thing. We all need allies. Allies are very important. We can't have a strong community without the help of others. That,
right.
It builds that strong bond.
Are there any other events that we haven't talked about?
So June 8th, we use the shelter at the Chris Larson Park. So the one that's right next to the Betty Strong Encounter Center, that huge shelter. We will just be having a day of just fun and festivities on the waterfront. Start at 11 a.m., go to 4 p.m. There will be a community fair. We've got about 35 different organizations and businesses that will have tables there, giving out information or selling product, whatever. We're going to have a kid space. We'll have face painting for them, crafts for them to do.
That was Karen Mackey, the executive director of the Siouxland Human Rights Commission, and Don Du, the head of the Disabilities Resource Center of Siouxland, talking about the upcoming Pride Week festivities. The first event, the Pride Prom, takes place this Friday night at Girls Inc. This weekend, a gender-bending punk rock musical hits the stage of Vanguard Arts in Sioux City. Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer talked to two people instrumental in this theatrical production.
The rock opera Hedwig and the Angry Inch took the world by storm when it appeared off Broadway back in 1998. 16's operation got botched. A guardian angel fell asleep on the watch. The show was award-winning and critically acclaimed before appearing on the big screen. I get down. I feel hot. With a movie starring one of the creators of the show, John Cameron Mitchell. Finally, Hedwig made its debut on Broadway 5 years ago, winning a Tony Award for Best Revival of a Musical, and it's soon hitting the stage here in Sioux City. Joining us is director Kathy Banta and Jesse Case, who stars as Hedwig.
Hello.
Hi.
First off, tell me about the story of Hedwig and the Angry Inch.
Long story short, Hansel is a boy that grew up on the east side of the Berlin Wall, and, you know, it was a war-torn area, and they were just trying to get out. By circumstance, he finds his way out, but he has to give something up to do so. And then the show itself is following him on his journey. Basically, you see all the raw emotion accumulative, like, over the past 20 years in this one character in an hour and a half.
And basically, it was a sex change that got botched.
Oh, absolutely. Got a sex change only because he thought that was the only way out, and it was a desperate measure. And he got out, and he got back to the States, and the wall went down, you know. I mean, that's not a spoiler. It happened.
Yeah, it was bad timing.
And then he realized he gave it all for pretty much nothing. If he would have been patient. You know, sometimes we don't have the luxury to be patient. But, you know, we just follow him on his journey from a little boy in East Berlin to a rock icon, in a sense.
And boy, is it relevant today with his struggle with the wall and, you know, what side of it you're on and trying to bring it down. And, yeah, there's a lot of parallels that we're brought to it to today's climate.
Yeah, even though the show was launched more than 20 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And it's going to hit the stage at Vanguard Arts. And how do you plan to stage this? This is going to be with a live band?
It is. We have a 4-piece band. And there is some video interaction with that. Jesse produced that as well.
So. I actually went to school at Western Iowa Tech for film with Chris Mansfield.
Oh, yeah. Chris Mansfield's amazing.
And so I, you know, I just thought that would have been a good idea to have kind of like a rock concert feel in the background. So I have like a, like many music videos playing in the back.
Oh, it's like a multimedia extravaganza. That'll be great. The show has so many different amazing songs. Kathy, what song do you enjoy the most in this show?
It's hard to say. It's toss up between Wicked Little Town and Midnight Radio.
Bends, dry.
And I get emotional every time he does
cries.
It. I just, I love it. It's that sappy. I told him that sappy saying that when you have to learn to accept the apology you never got. And it's like, oh, that's stupid. But the show just brings you full circle and you get to see that happen in Hedwig.
Should I put you on the spot, Jesse? Do you want to sing a few bars?
Oh, man.
Of that song? Or do you want to do your favorite?
On the spot.
Sugar Daddy.
That's probably that.
My favorite line from the song is, I'll be a Venus on a chocolate clamshell, rise out of sea marshmallow foam. If you got some sugar for me, Sugar Daddy, bring it home.
That's beautiful.
I love it.
If you got some sugar for me, Sugar Daddy, bring it home.
You know, the first part deals with the sex change that was botched, and then it seems like the rest of the show, Hedwig is chasing this person that stole the songs,
right?
That she wrote.
Yeah, whatever identity she had was basically stolen. So I'd be a little miffed too. And, you know, we've all had, you know, instances where things been taken from us that we can't get back.
I think it's transcending that because. John Cameron Mitchell talks about that when people ask, because normally he's playing, he's playing a man who's had a botched sex change, and his husband, Yitzhak, who's played by Ashley Reck, traditionally is played by a woman, but it is, you know, Hedwig's husband. So when people ask him, it's like, well, it's kind of confusing. Who's supposed to be what? And he says, well, this is supposed to transcend gender. You know, this is just a person who's looking for love. So while he, you know, it's kind of Hedwig's journey that he's focused on the outside, which he now feels is botched, when he finally turns that focus in is when he gets the answers he needs.
Has this ever been done here in Sioux City?
I don't believe so.
I don't think so. I've been waiting because this is a show. The movie was amazing as well. Mm-hmm. And if you know the music at all, it's something that you kind of seek and you want to see. And so when you called and said, hey, we're doing the show and we need to get you on and talk about Hedwig and the Angry Inch.
And I can't talk it up enough. It's so much fun to watch. It's visually stunning. The music's good. It's just a ride from the start to the end.
Hedwig and the Angry Inch opens Saturday night, June 1st, and runs for 3 weeks at Vanguard Arts. For tickets and more information, go to vanguardarts.com. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Well, you can tell it's summer in Sioux City because this Friday, Food Truck Fridays begin. The summer-long food truck and music events are every Friday from 11 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. at the Pearl Street Park across from the Launchpad Children's Museum. Sam Burrish is a volunteer organizer for the event.
Food Truck Fridays is in its fourth season. Our goal is to build a food truck scene and promote food culture, which goes along with entrepreneurship and all ties together to create a vibrant community, vibrant downtown district. So it's definitely a quality of life project.
You talk about quality of life. It does help, you know, you're downtown, you're working, you can go outside and get a bite to eat and get out of the office and talk to people.
What's really neat is we anticipated a lot of business people who work downtown, but the event truly represents our entire community. You'll see a lot of younger people, older people, mothers with kids, families. The attendance truly represents the community, in addition to being, you know, easily accessible for those working downtown.
So what kind of food trucks are going to be there this year?
We have a record number of trucks on the roster for this season. Many are returning from last season, but also we've had a good number of people who decided to open a truck, have maybe an existing truck and have added a truck to their business. And so it's really exciting, just the variety. We're going to have everything from barbecue to Mexican, Asian, fair-type food, sandwiches, sweets, hot dogs, lunch bowls, ice cream, coffee, fruit beverages, and just a whole spectrum of anything that you could want. It's 11 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. each Friday, starting May 31st through the second to last week in August, which I believe is the 23rd. So it's a 13-week season. Many vend regularly in the Siouxland area, but also a number come from across the region, maybe up to 100 miles away. So truly, it's a destination event for the region, in addition to the local trucks that you know and love.
And Food Truck Fridays are really made possible by people who are volunteering their time.
Food Truck Fridays is organized by volunteers and is made possible with community partnerships. And so that truly takes on the entrepreneurial spirit and then also, you know, helps provide something for the community. So we're really grateful for the volunteer support and also support from the City of Sioux City, downtown partners, and also Siouxland Public Media.
The location this year, the Pearl Street Park, is really nice and it offers a lot that maybe the other location didn't have.
It's a relatively new park. It offers abundant seating, grassy areas, and kid-friendly features. New this year are extra table umbrellas to offer additional shaded seating. And select weeks, we're also going to feature live music by local artists. And so we're really excited about the partnership with Siouxland Public Media, helping facilitate the live music, and then also helping get the word out for us. And so I've been, you know, working with Mark Munger over the last couple months, just like we did last year, to kind of start doing prep work for that. We're going to, you know, start the season with the focus on the food, and then as the summer progresses, highlight local musical artists select weeks throughout the rest of the season.
That was Sam Burrish, one of the organizers of Sioux City's Food Truck Fridays, which begins this Friday at the Pearl Street Park at 620 Pearl Street from 11 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. There's a roster of 24 trucks who will be selling food and drink over the summer, and Siouxland Public Media is helping out with the event as well. We'll have updates on the music you can expect to hear when you go to Food Truck Fridays. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. On Memorial Day, we remembered the sacrifice of those who served our country in the U.S. military. A Sioux City man shared a special story he wrote in honor of his father's service. Here's This Is My Father's Flag with Bob Protexter, produced by Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer.
This Is My Father's Flag of Donald Homer Protexter. This is my father's flag in memoriam of his dedicated and diligent service to the United States of America. I have to write this because I knew he never would. This is my father's flag that is located in the row of flags in the front row of Graceland Park Cemetery, that is located on Lakeport Avenue in the neighborhood of Morningside, that is located in Sioux City, Iowa, that is located in the United States of America. This is my father's flag, donated by our family in recognition of his service to our country in World War II. Some call it the Second World War. Some call it the Great Patriotic War. The First World War was the war to end all wars, but of course this was not the case. So there is a World War II. My father's flag for time spent and time wagered in the 1940s in parts far away in Egypt, in Italy, in France, and in many more parts unknown in towns and fields and places and mountains
and more
and
valleys
and more places
and more places
and more places that would even be difficult to locate on the best of maps. This is my father's flag for time allowed to write letters home to his mother.
Meet again, don't know where, don't know when, but I
for Time Not Allowed for Sleep, for two packs of Lucky Strikes, one in a game of cards, where the winners smoked and the losers played again so that they could smoke, for drinking coffee out of a tin mug, for wearing the color of military green for years at a time, for wearing that same colored helmet for 24 hours at a time, and again for letters that were sent to home detailing the helmets, the green, the coffee, the cigarettes, and the sleep not allowed. This is my father's flag for driving wide ammunition trucks over thin bridges, obtaining scars that would never go away, and obtaining sights that would never be spoken about again. This is my father's flag for his service to his country as a serviceman in the 34th Infantry Division, also known as the Red Bull. This is my father's flag that is located at the intersection of Sunnybrook and Lakeport, directly by and closest to the signal light that is located some thousands of miles away from where many countrymen were laid to rest. And this is my father's flag located some mere feet from where he was laid to rest. With flag folded, with family emboldened, with widow molded, this is my father's flag.
After his military service, Donald Homer Protexter was best known as the head baseball coach at Morningside College, a post he held from 1955 until his untimely death in the summer of 1983 at the age of 60. His son Bob carries on his baseball legacy. Bob Protexter is currently in Moscow helping coach the Russian national baseball team.
You're a grand old flag, you're a high-flying flag, and forever in peace may you wave. You're the emblem of the land I love, the home of the free and the brave. Every heart beats true under red, white, and blue.
Bluebirds over the white cliffs of Dover. Tomorrow, just you wait and see. There'll be love and
hope. Oh, there, oh, there, gentlemen, oh, there, that the Yanks are coming, the Yanks are coming, the drums from coming everywhere. So
and that was This Is My Father's Flag with Bob Protexter, produced by Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer. And that's it for this week's edition of The Exchange. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Mary Hartnett. We'll see you next week.